chair and a half in the living room. She stood ready to move, but her legs needed further instruction. What did she come in here for? She retraced her steps. Blanket and book, glass on counter, porch with John. He was leaving soon to attend the International Conference on Alzheimer's Disease. Sunday, maybe? She'd have to ask him to be sure. They were about to go for a run. It was a little cool out. She came in for a fleece. No, that wasn't it. She was already wearing one. To hell with it. Just as she reached the front door, an urgent pressure in her bladder announced itself, and she remembered that she really had to pee. She hastened back down the hall and opened the door to the bathroom. Only, to her utter disbelief, it wasn't the bathroom. A broom, mop, bucket, vacuum cleaner, stool, toolbox, light bulbs, flashlights, bleach. The utility closet. She looked farther down the hall. The kitchen to the left, the living room to the right, and that was it. There was a half bath on this floor, wasn't there? There had to be. It was right here, but it wasn't. She hurried to the kitchen but found only one door, and it led to the back porch. She raced over to the living room, but of course there wasn't a bathroom off the living room. She rushed back to the hallway and held the doorknob. Please God, please God, please God. She swung open the door like an illusionist revealing her most mystifying trick, but the bathroom didn't magically reappear. How can I be lost in my own home? She thought about bolting upstairs to the full bath, but she was strangely stuck and dumbfounded in the Twilight Zone-like bathroomless dimension of the first floor. She was unable to hold it in any longer. She had an ethereal sense of observing herself, this poor, unfamiliar woman crying in the hallway. It didn't sound like the somewhat guarded cry of an adult woman. It was the scared, defeated, and unrestrained crying of a small child. Her tears weren't all she wasn't able to contain any longer. John burst through the front door just in time to witness the urine streaming down her right leg, soaking her sweatpants, sock, and sneaker. Don't look at me. Allie, don't cry. It's okay. I don't know where I am. It's okay. You're right here. I'm lost. You're not lost, Allie. You're with me. He held her and rocked her slightly side to side, soothing her as she'd seen him calm their children after innumerable physical injuries and social injustices. I couldn't find the bathroom. It's okay. I'm sorry. Don't be sorry. It's okay. Come on, let's get you changed. The day is already heating up. You need something lighter anyway. Before John left for the conference, he gave Lydia detailed instructions concerning Alice's medications, her running routine, her cell phone, and the safe return program. He also gave her the neurologist's phone number, just in case. When Alice replayed his little speech in her head, it sounded very much like the ones they had delivered to their teenage babysitters before leaving the kids for weekends away in Maine or Vermont. Now she needed to be watched. By her own daughter. After their first dinner alone together at the Squire, Alice and Lydia walked down Main Street without talking. The line of luxury cars and SUVs parked along the curb, outfitted with bike racks and kayaks bungeed on roofs, crammed with baby strollers, beach chairs, and umbrellas, and sporting license plates from Connecticut, New York, and New Jersey, in addition to Massachusetts, signaled the summer season officially in full swing. Families ambled along the sidewalk without regard for lanes of pedestrian traffic, unhurried and without specific destinations, stopping, backtracking, and window shopping, like they had all the time in the world. An easy 10-minute stroll removed them from the congested downtown. They stopped in front of the Chatham Lighthouse and breathed in the panoramic view of the beach below before walking the 30 steps down to the sand. A modest line of sandals and flip-flops waited at the bottom where they'd been kicked off earlier in the day. Alice and Lydia added their shoes to the end of the row and continued walking. The sign in front of them read, "Warning, strong current. surf subject to unexpected life-threatening waves and currents. No lifeguard. Hazardous area for swimming and wading, diving and water skiing, sailboards and small boats, rafts and canoes. Alice watched and listened to the relentless breaking waves pounding the shore. If it weren't for the colossal seawall constructed at the edges of the properties of the million-dollar homes along Shore Road, the ocean would have taken each house in, devouring them all without sympathy or apology. She imagined her Alzheimer's like this ocean at Lighthouse Beach. Unstoppable, ferocious, destructive. Only there were no seawalls in her brain to protect her memories and thoughts from the onslaught. "I'm sorry I didn't get to go to your play," she said to Lydia. "It's all right. I know it was because of Dad this time." "I can't wait to see the one you're in this summer." "Uh-huh." The sun hung low and impossibly big in the pink and blue sky, ready to plunge into the Atlantic. They walked by a man kneeling in the sand, aiming his camera at the horizon, trying to capture its fleeting beauty before it disappeared with the sun. "This conference Dad's at is about Alzheimer's?" "Yes." "Is he trying to find a better treatment there?" "He is." "Do you think he'll find one?" Alice watched the tide coming in, erasing footprints, demolishing an elaborate sandcastle decorated with shells, filling in a hole dug earlier that day with plastic shovels, ridding the shore of its daily history. She envied the beautiful homes behind the seawall. "No." Alice picked up a shell. She rubbed the sand off, revealing its milky white shine and elegant ribbons of pink. She liked its smooth feel, but it was broken on one edge. She thought about tossing it into the water, but decided to keep it. "Well, I'm sure he wouldn't take the time to go if he didn't think he could find something," said Lydia. Two girls wearing University of Massachusetts sweatshirts walked toward them, giggling. Alice smiled at them and said hello as they passed. "I wish you'd go to college," said Alice. "Mom, please don't." Not wanting to start their week together with a full-blown fight, Alice silently reminisced while they walked. The professors she'd loved and feared and made a fool of herself in front of. The boys she'd loved and feared and made an even bigger fool of herself in front of. The punchy all-nighters before exams, the classes, the parties, the friendships, meeting John. Her memories of that time in her life were vivid, perfectly intact, and easily accessed. They were almost a little cocky the way they came to her, so full and ready, like they had no knowledge of the war going on just a few centimeters to their left. Whenever she thought about college, her thoughts ultimately bumped into January of her freshman year. A little over 3 hours after her family had visited and left for home, Alice had heard a tentative knock on her dorm room door. She still remembered every detail of the dean standing in her doorway. The single deep crease between his eyebrows, the boyish part in his grandfatherly gray hair, the woolly pills budding all over his forest green sweater, the low, careful cadence of his voice. Her father had driven the car off Route 93 and into a tree. He might have fallen asleep. He might have had too much to drink at dinner. He always had too much to drink at dinner. He was in a hospital in Manchester. Her mother and her sister were dead. "John, is that you?" "No, it's just me bringing in the towels. It's about to pour," said Lydia. The air was charged and heavy. They were due for some rain. The weather had cooperated all week with postcard sunny days and perfect sleeping temperatures each night. Her brain had cooperated all week, too. She'd come to recognize the difference between days that would be fraught with difficulties finding memories and words and bathrooms and days that her Alzheimer's would lie silent and not interfere. On those days, she was her normal self, the self she understood and had confidence in. On those days, she could almost convince herself that Dr. Davis and the genetic counselor had been wrong, or that the last 6 months had been a horrible dream, only a nightmare, the monster under her bed and clawing at her covers not real. From the living room, Alice watched Lydia fold towels and stack them on one of the kitchen stools. She wore a light blue spaghetti strap tank top and a black skirt. She looked freshly showered. Alice still wore her bathing suit under a faded fish print beach dress. "Should I get changed?" she asked. "If you want to." Lydia returned clean mugs to a cabinet and checked her watch. Then she came into the living room, gathered the magazines and catalogs from the couch and floor, and piled them into a neat stack on the coffee table. She checked her watch. She took a copy of Cape Cod magazine off the top of the pile, sat down on the couch, and began flipping through it. They seemed to be killing time, but Alice didn't understand why. Something wasn't right. "Where's John?" asked Alice. Lydia looked up from the magazine, either amused or embarrassed, or maybe both. Alice couldn't tell. "He should be home any minute."
"So we're waiting for him."
"Uh-huh."
"Where's Anne?"
"Anna's in Boston, with Charlie."
"No, Anne, my sister. Where's Anne?"
Lydia stared at her without blinking, all lightness drained from her face.
"Mom, Anne's dead. She died in a car accident with your mother."
Lydia's eyes didn't move from Alice's. Alice stopped breathing, and her heart squeezed like a fist. Her head and fingers went numb, and the world around her became dark and narrow. She took in a huge breath of air. It filled her head and fingers with oxygen, and it filled her pounding heart with rage and grief. She began to shake and cry.
"No, Mom, this happened a long time ago, remember?"
Lydia was talking to her, but Alice couldn't hear what she was saying. She could only feel the rage and grief coursing through her every cell, her sick heart, and her hot tears, and she could only hear her own voice in her head screaming for Anne and her mother. John stood over them, drenched.
"What happened?"
"She was asking for Anne. She thinks they just died." He held her head in his hands. He was talking to her, trying to calm her down.
Why isn't he upset, too?
"He's known about this for a while, that's why, and he's been keeping it from me." She couldn't trust him. August 2004. Her mother and sister had died when she was a freshman in college. No pictures of her mother or Anne filled a single page in their family photo albums. There was no evidence of them at her graduations, her wedding, or with her, John, and the children on holidays, vacations, or birthdays. She couldn't picture her mother as an old woman, and she certainly would be now, and Anne hadn't aged beyond a teenager in her mind. Still, she'd been so sure that they were about to walk through the front door, not as ghosts from the past, but alive and well, and that they were coming to stay at the house in Chatham with them for the summer. She was somewhat scared that she could become that confused, that awake and sober, she could wholeheartedly expect a visit from her long-dead mother and sister. It was even scarier that this scared her only somewhat. Alice, John, and Lydia sat at the patio table on the porch eating breakfast. Lydia was talking to them about the members of her summer ensemble and her rehearsals, but mostly she was talking to John. "I was so intimidated before I got here, you know. I mean, you should see all of their bios. MFAs in theater from NYU and the Actors Studio and degrees from Yale, experience on Broadway."
"Wow, sounds like a very experienced group. What's the age range?" he asked.
"Oh, I'm easily the youngest. Most are probably in their 30s and 40s, but there's a man and woman as old as you and Mom."
"That old, huh?"
"You know what I mean. Anyway, I didn't know if I'd be totally out of my league, but the training I've been piecing together and the work I've been getting has really given me the right tools. I totally know what I'm doing." Alice remembered having the same insecurity and realization in her first months as a professor at Harvard. "They all definitely have more experience than me, but none of them have studied Meisner. They all studied Stanislavski or the method, but I really think Meisner is the most powerful approach for true spontaneity in acting. So even though I don't have as much onstage experience, I bring something unique to the group."
"That's great, honey. That's probably one of the reasons they cast you." What's spontaneity in acting mean exactly? John asked. Alice had wondered the same thing, but her words, viscous and amyloid goo, lagged behind John's, as they so often seemed to now in real-time conversation. So she listened to her husband and daughter ramble effortlessly ahead of her and watched them as participants on stage from her seat in the audience. She cut her sesame bagel in half and took a bite. She didn't like it plain. Several condiment options sat on the table. Wild Maine blueberry jam, a jar of peanut butter, a stick of butter on a plate, and a tub of white butter. But it wasn't called white butter. What was it called? Not mayonnaise. No, it was too thick, like butter. What was its name? She pointed her butter knife at it. John, can you pass that to me? John handed her the tub of white butter. She spread a thick layer onto one of the bagel halves and stared at it. She knew exactly how it would taste, and that she liked it, but she couldn't bring herself to bite into it until she could tell herself its name. Lydia watched her mother studying her bagel. Cream cheese, Mom. Right, cream cheese. Thank you, Lydia. The phone rang, and John went inside the house to answer it. The first thought that jumped to the front of Alice's mind was that it was her mother, calling to let them know she was going to be late getting there. The thought, seemingly realistic and colored with immediacy, appeared as reasonable as expecting John to return to the patio table within the next few minutes. Alice corrected the impetuous thought, scolded it, and put it away. Her mother and sister had died when she was a freshman in college. It was maddening to have to keep reminding herself of this. Alone with her daughter, at least for the moment, she took the opportunity to get a word in. Lydia, what about going to school for a degree in theater? Mom, didn't you understand a word of what I was just saying? I don't need a degree. I heard every word of what you said, and I understood it all. I was thinking more big picture. I'm sure there are aspects of your craft that you haven't yet explored, things you could still learn, maybe even directing. The point is, a degree opens more doors should you ever need them. And what doors are those? Well, for one, the degree would give you the credibility to teach if you ever wanted to. Mom, I want to be an actor, not a teacher. That's you, not me. I know that, Lydia. You've made that abundantly clear. I'm not necessarily thinking of a teacher at a university or college anyway, although you could. I was thinking that you could someday run workshops, just like the ones you've been taking and love so much. Mom, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to spend any energy on thinking about what I might do if I'm not good enough to make it as an actor. I don't need to doubt myself like that. I'm not doubting that you can have a career as an actor. But what if you decide to have a family someday, and you'd like to slow down a bit but still stay in the business? Teaching workshops, even from your home, might be a nice flexibility to have. Plus, it's not always what you know, but who you know. The networking possibilities you'd have with classmates, professors, alumni, I'm sure there's an inner circle you simply don't have access to without a degree or a body of work already proven in the business. Alice paused, waiting for Lydia's, "Yeah, but..." But she didn't say anything. Just consider it. Life only gets busier. It's a harder thing to fit in as you get older. Maybe talk to some of the people in your ensemble and get their perspectives on what's involved in continuing an acting career into your 30s and 40s and older. Okay? Okay. Okay. That was the closest they'd ever come to an agreement on the subject. Alice tried to think of something else to talk about, but couldn't. For so long now, they had talked only about this. The silence between them grew. Mom, what does it feel like? What does what feel like? Having Alzheimer's. Can you feel that you have it right now? Well, I know I'm not confused or repeating myself right now, but just a few minutes ago I couldn't find cream cheese, and I was having a hard time participating in the conversation with you and your dad. I know it's only a matter of time before those types of things happen again, and the times between when it happens are getting shorter, and the things that are happening are getting bigger. So even when I feel completely normal, I know I'm not.
It's not over, it's just a rest. I don't trust myself.
As soon as she finished, she worried she'd admitted too much. She didn't want to scare her daughter. But Lydia didn't flinch and stayed interested, and Alice relaxed.
So you know when it's happening?
Most of the time.
Like what was happening when you couldn't think of the name for cream cheese?
I know what I'm looking for. My brain just can't get to it.
It's like if you decided you wanted that glass of water, only your hand won't pick it up. You ask it nicely, you threaten it, but it just won't budge.
You might finally get it to move, but then you grab the salt shaker instead, or you knock the glass and spill the water all over the table.
Or by the time you get your hand to hold the glass and bring it to your lips, the itch in your throat has cleared, and you don't need a drink anymore. The moment of need has passed.
That sounds like torture, Mom.
It is.
I'm so sorry you have this.
Thanks.
Lydia reached out across the dishes and glasses in years of distance and held her mother's hand. Alice squeezed it and smiled. Finally, they'd found something else they could talk about. Alice woke up on the couch. She'd been napping a lot lately, sometimes twice a day. While her attention and energy benefited greatly from the extra rest, re-entry into the day was jarring. She looked at the clock on the wall. 4:15. She couldn't remember what time she had dozed off. She remembered eating lunch. A sandwich, some kind of sandwich with John. That was probably around noon. The corner of something hard pressed into her hip. The book she'd been reading. She must have fallen asleep while reading. 4:20. Lydia's rehearsal ran until 7. She sat up and listened. She could hear the seagulls squawking at Harding's and imagined their scavenger hunt, a mad race to find and devour every last crumb left behind by those careless, sunburned humans. She stood up and set out on her own hunt, less frenzied than the gulls, for John. She checked their bedroom and study. She looked out into the driveway. No car. Just about to curse him for not leaving a note, she found it under a magnet on the refrigerator door. Allie, went for a drive. Be back soon. John. She sat back down on the couch and picked up her book, Sense and Sensibility, by Jane Austen, but didn't open it. She didn't really want to be reading it now. She'd been about halfway through Moby Dick and lost it. She and John had turned the house upside down without success. They'd even looked in every peculiar spot that only a demented person would place a book. The refrigerator and freezer, the pantry, their dresser drawers, the linen closet, the fireplace. But neither of them could find it. She'd probably left it at the beach. She hoped she'd left it at the beach. That was at least something she would have done before Alzheimer's. John had offered to pick her up another copy. Maybe he'd gone to the bookstore. She hoped he had. If she waited much longer, she'd forget what she'd already read and have to start over. All that work. Just the thought of it made her tired again. In the meantime, she had started Jane Austen, whom she'd always liked, but this one wasn't holding her attention. She wandered upstairs to Lydia's bedroom. Of her three children, she knew Lydia the least. On the top of her dresser, turquoise and silver rings, a leather necklace, and a colorfully beaded one spilled over an open cardboard box. Next to the box sat a pile of hair clips and a tray for burning incense. Lydia was a bit of a hippie. Her clothes lay all over the floor, some folded, most not. There couldn't have been much of anything actually in her dresser drawers. She'd left her bed unmade. Lydia was a bit of a slob. Books of poetry and plays lined the shelves of her bookcase. Night Mother, Dinner with Friends, Proof, A Delicate Balance, Spoon River Anthology, Agnes of God, Angels in America, Oleana. Lydia was an actress. She picked up several of the plays and flipped through them. They were each only about 80 to 90 pages, and each of those pages was only sparsely filled with text. Maybe it'd be easier and more satisfying to read plays, and I could talk about them with Lydia. She held on to Proof.
Lydia's journal, iPod, Sanford Meisner on acting, and a framed picture sat on her nightstand. Alice picked up the journal. She hesitated, but barely. She didn't have the luxury of time. Sitting on the bed, she read page after page of her daughter's dreams and confessions. She read about blocks and breakthroughs in acting classes, fears and hopes surrounding auditions, disappointments and joys over castings. She read about a young woman's passion and tenacity. She read about Malcolm. While they were acting in a dramatic scene together in class, Lydia had fallen in love with him. She'd thought she might be pregnant once, but wasn't. She was relieved, not ready yet to get married or have children. She wanted to find her own way in the world first. Alice studied the framed photograph of Lydia and a man, presumably Malcolm. Their smiling faces touched. They were happy, the man and woman in the picture. Lydia was a woman. "Allie, are you here?" called John. "I'm upstairs." She returned the journal and picture to the nightstand and stole downstairs. "Where'd you go?" Alice asked. "I went for a drive." He held two white plastic bags, one in each hand. "Did you buy me a new copy of Moby Dick?" "Sort of." He handed Alice one of the bags. It was filled with DVDs. Moby Dick with Gregory Peck and Orson Welles. King Lear with Laurence Olivier. Casablanca, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and The Sound of Music, her all-time favorite. "I was thinking these might be a lot easier for you, and we can do this together." She smiled. "What's in the other bag?" She felt giddy, like a little kid on Christmas morning. He pulled out a package of microwave popcorn and a box of Milk Duds. "Can we watch The Sound of Music first?" she asked. "Sure." "I love you, John." She threw her arms around him. "I love you too, Allie." With her hands high on his back, she pressed her face against his chest and breathed him in. She wanted to say more to him about what he meant to her, but she couldn't find the words. He held her a little tighter. He knew. They stood still in the kitchen holding on to each other without uttering a word for a long time. "Here, you nuke the popcorn and I'll put the movie in and meet you on the couch," said John. "Okay." She walked over to the microwave, opened the door, and laughed. She had to laugh. "I found Moby Dick." Alice had been up alone for a couple of hours. In that early morning solitude, she drank green tea, read a little, and practiced yoga out on the lawn. Posed in downward dog, she filled her lungs with the delicious morning ocean air and luxuriated in the strange, almost painful pleasure of the stretch in her hamstrings and glutes. Out of the corner of her eye, she observed her left triceps engaged in holding her body in this position. Solid, sculpted, beautiful. Her whole body looked strong and beautiful. She was in the best physical shape of her life. Good food plus daily exercise equaled the strength in her flexed triceps muscles, the flexibility in her hips, her strong calves, and easy breathing during a 4-mile run. Then, of course, there was her mind. Unresponsive, disobedient, weakening. She took Aricept, Namenda, the mystery Amylyx trial pill, Lipitor, vitamin C and E, and baby aspirin. She consumed additional antioxidants in the form of blueberries, red wine, and dark chocolate. She drank green tea. She tried ginkgo biloba. She meditated and played Numero. She brushed her teeth with her left, non-dominant hand. She slept when she was tired. Yet none of these efforts seemed to add up to visible, measurable results. Maybe her cognitive capabilities would noticeably worsen if she subtracted the exercise, the Aricept, or the blueberries. Maybe, unopposed, her dementia would run amok. Maybe. But maybe all of these things didn't affect anything. She couldn't know, unless she went off her meds, eliminated chocolate and wine, and sat on her ass for the next month. This was not an experiment she was willing to conduct.
She stepped into warrior pose. She exhaled and sank deeper into the lunge, accepting the discomfort an additional challenge to her concentration and stamina, determined to maintain the pose, determined to remain a warrior. John emerged from the kitchen, bedheaded and zombie-like, but dressed to run. "You want coffee first?" asked Alice. "No, let's just go. I'll have it when we get back." They ran 2 miles every morning along Main Street to the center of town and returned via the same route. John's body had grown noticeably leaner and defined, and he could run that distance easily now, but he didn't enjoy 1 second of it. He ran with her, resigned and uncomplaining, but with the same enthusiasm and zest he had for paying the bills or doing the laundry, and she loved him for it. She ran behind him, letting him set the pace, watching and listening to him like he was a gorgeous musical instrument. The pendulum-like swinging back of his elbows, the rhythmic, airy puffs of his exhales, the percussion of his sneakers on the sandy pavement. Then he spit, and she laughed. He didn't ask why. They were on their way back when she ran up beside him. But then, following his turn, they ran right at a fork onto Mill Road toward home, where she would have gone left. Alzheimer's did not like to be ignored. Back home, she thanked him, kissed him on his sweaty cheek, and then went straight and unshowered to Lydia, who was still in her pajamas and drinking coffee on the porch. Each morning, she and Lydia discussed whatever play Alice was reading over multigrain cereal with blueberries or a sesame bagel with cream cheese and coffee and tea. Alice's instinct had been right. She enjoyed reading plays infinitely more than reading novels or biographies, and talking over what she'd just read with Lydia, whether it was scene one, act one, or the entire play, proved a delightful and powerful way of reinforcing her memory of it. In analyzing scenes, character, and plot with Lydia, Alice saw the depth of her daughter's intellect, her rich understanding of human need and emotion and struggle. She saw Lydia, and she loved her. Today, they discussed a scene from Angels in America. They passed eager questions and answers back and forth, their conversation two-way, equal, fun. And because Alice didn't have to compete with John to complete her thoughts, she could take her time and not get left behind. "What was it like doing the scene with Malcolm?" Alice asked. Lydia stared at her as if the question blew her mind. "What? Didn't you and Malcolm perform the scene together in your class? You read my journal?" Alice's stomach hollowed out. She thought Lydia had told her about Malcolm. "Sweetie, I'm sorry. I can't believe you did that. You have no right." Lydia shoved her chair back and stormed off, leaving Alice alone at the table, stunned and queasy. A few minutes later, Alice heard the front door slam. "Don't worry, she'll calm down," said John. All morning she tried to do something else. She tried to clean, to garden, to read, but all she could manage to do effectively was worry. She worried she'd done something unforgivable. She worried she'd just lost the respect, trust, and love of the daughter she'd only begun to know. After lunch, Alice and John walked to Harding's Beach. Alice swam until her body felt too exhausted to feel anything else. The hollowed-out flip-flopping in her stomach gone, she returned to her beach chair, lay in the fully reclined position with her eyes closed, and meditated. She had read that regular meditation could increase cortical thickness and slow age-related cortical thinning. Lydia was already meditating every day, and when Alice had expressed an interest, Lydia taught her. Whether it helped to preserve her cortical thickness or not, Alice liked the time of quiet focus, how it so effectively hushed the cluttered noise and worry in her head. It literally gave her peace of mind. After about 20 minutes, she returned to a more wakeful state, relaxed, energized, and hot. She waded back into the ocean, just for a quick dip this time, exchanging sweat and heat for salt and cool. Back in her chair, she overheard a woman on the blanket next to them talking about the wonderful play she'd just seen at the Monomoy Theater. The hollowed-out flip-flopping surged back in. That evening, John grilled cheeseburgers, and Alice made a salad. Lydia didn't come home for dinner. "I'm sure rehearsal's just running a bit late," said John. "She hates me now." "She doesn't hate you." After dinner, Alice drank 2 more glasses of red wine, and John drank 3 more glasses of scotch with ice. Still no Lydia. After Alice added her evening dose of pills to her unsettled stomach, they sat on the couch together with a bowl of popcorn and a box of Milk Duds and watched King Lear. John woke her on the couch. The television was off, and the house was dark. She must have fallen asleep before the movie ended. She didn't remember the ending, anyway. He guided her up the stairs to their bedroom. She stood at the side of the bed, her hand over her disbelieving mouth, tears in her eyes, the worry expelled from her stomach and mind. Lydia's journal lay on her pillow. "Sorry I'm late," said Tom, walking in. "Okay, everyone, now that Tom's here, Charlie and I have some news to share," said Anna. "I'm 5 weeks pregnant with twins." Hugs and kisses and congratulations were followed by excited questions and answers and interruptions and more questions and answers. As her ability to track what was said in complex conversations with many participants declined, Alice's sensitivity to what wasn't said, to body language and unspoken feelings, had heightened. She had explained this phenomenon a couple of weeks ago to Lydia, who had told her it was an enviable skill to have as an actor. She'd said that she and other actors had to focus extremely hard to divorce themselves from verbal language in an effort to be honestly affected by what the other actors were doing and feeling. Alice didn't quite understand the distinction, but she loved Lydia for seeing her handicap as an enviable skill. John looked happy and excited, but Alice saw that he exposed only some of the happiness and excitement he actually felt, probably trying to respect Anna's caveat of, "It's still early." Even without Anna's cautioning, he was superstitious, as most biologists were, and wouldn't be inclined to openly count these 2 little chickens before they hatched. But he already couldn't wait. He wanted grandchildren. Just beneath Charlie's happiness and excitement, Alice saw a thick layer of nervousness covering a thicker layer of terror. Alice thought they were both obviously visible, but Anna seemed oblivious and no one else commented. Was she simply seeing the typical worry of an expectant first-time father? Was he nervous about the responsibility of feeding 2 mouths at once and paying for 2 college tuitions simultaneously? That would explain only the first layer. Was he also terrified about the prospect of having 2 kids in college and at the same time a wife with dementia? Lydia and Tom stood next to each other, talking to Anna. Her children were beautiful, her children who weren't children anymore. Lydia looked radiant. She was enjoying the good news on top of the fact that her entire family was here to see her act. Tom's smile was genuine, but Alice saw a subtle uneasiness about him, his eyes and cheeks slightly sunken, his body bonier. Was it school? A girlfriend? He saw her studying him. "Mom, how are you feeling?" he asked. "Mostly good." "Really?" "Yes, honestly, I'm feeling great." "You seem too quiet." "There's too many of us talking at once and too quickly," said Lydia. Tom's smile disappeared, and he looked like he might cry. Alice's BlackBerry in her baby blue bag vibrated against her hip, signaling the time for her evening dose of pills. She'd wait a few minutes. She didn't want to take them just now, in front of Tom. "Lyd, what time is your performance tomorrow?" asked Alice, her BlackBerry in hand. 8:00. "Mom, you don't have to schedule it. We're all here. It's not like we're going to forget to bring you with us," said Tom. "What's the name of the play we're going to see?" asked Anna. "Proof," said Lydia. "Are you nervous?" asked Tom. "A little, because it's opening night, and you're all going to be there. But I'll forget you exist once I'm on stage." "Lydia, what time is your play?" asked Alice. "Mom, you just asked that. Don't worry about it," said Tom. "It's at 8:00, Mom," said Lydia. "Tom, you're not helping."
No, you're not helping. Why should she have to worry about remembering something that she doesn't have to remember?
She won't worry about it if she puts it in her BlackBerry. Just let her do it, said Lydia.
Well, she shouldn't be relying on that BlackBerry anyway. She should be exercising her memory whenever she can, said Anna.
So which is it? Should she be memorizing my showtime or totally relying on us? Asked Lydia.
You should be encouraging her to focus and really pay attention. She should try to recall the information on her own and not get lazy, said Anna.
She's not lazy, said Lydia.
You and that BlackBerry are enabling her.
Look, Mom, what time is Lydia's show tomorrow? Asked Anna.
I don't know. That's why I asked her, said Alice.
She told you the answer twice, Mom. Can you try to remember what she said?
Anna, stop quizzing her, said Tom.
I was going to enter it in my BlackBerry, but you interrupted me.
I'm not asking you to look it up in your BlackBerry. I'm asking you to remember the time she said.
Well, I didn't try to remember the time because I was going to punch it in.
Mom, just think for a second. What time is Lydia's show tomorrow?
She didn't know the answer, but she knew that poor Anna needed to be put in her place.
Lydia, what time is your show tomorrow? Asked Alice.
8 o'clock.
It's at 8 o'clock, Anna.
5 minutes before 8 o'clock, they settled in their seats, second row, center. The Monomoy Theater was an intimate venue, with only 100 seats and a stage floor just a few feet from the first row. Alice couldn't wait for the lights to go down. She'd read this play and talked about it extensively with Lydia. She'd even helped her run lines. Lydia was playing Catherine, daughter of her mathematical genius-gone-mad father. Alice couldn't wait to see these characters come alive right in front of her. From the very first scene, the acting was nuanced, honest, and multidimensional, and Alice became easily and completely absorbed in the imaginary world the actors created. Catherine claimed she'd written a groundbreaking proof, but neither her love interest nor her estranged sister believed her, and they both questioned her mental stability. She tortured herself with the fear that, like her genius father, she might be going crazy. Alice experienced her pain, betrayal, and fear right along with her. She was mesmerizing from beginning to end. Afterward, the actors came out into the audience. Catherine beamed. John gave her flowers and a huge, emphatic hug.
"You were amazing, absolutely incredible," said John.
"Thank you so much. Isn't it such a great play?" The others hugged and kissed and praised her, too.
"You were brilliant, beautiful to watch," said Alice.
"Thank you."
"Will we get to see you in anything else this summer?" asked Alice.
She looked at Alice for an uncomfortably long time before she answered.
"No, this is my only role for the summer."
"Are you here for just the summer season?"
The question seemed to make her sad as she considered it. Her eyes welled with tears.
"Yes, I'm moving back to L.A. at the end of August, but I'll be back this way a lot to visit with my family."
"Mom, that's Lydia, your daughter," said Anna.
The well-being of a neuron depends on its ability to communicate with other neurons. Studies have shown that electrical and chemical stimulation from both a neuron's inputs and its targets support vital cellular processes. Neurons unable to connect effectively with other neurons atrophy. Useless, an abandoned neuron will die. September, 2004. Although it was officially the beginning of fall semester at Harvard, the weather was steadfastly adhering to the rules according to the Roman calendar. It was a sticky 80 degrees that summer morning in September as Alice began her commute to Harvard Yard. In the days just before and following matriculation each year, it always amused her to see the first-year students who weren't from New England. Fall in Cambridge evoked images of vibrant leaves, apple picking, football games, and wool sweaters with scarves. While it wouldn't be unusual to wake up on a late September morning in Cambridge to find frost on the pumpkin, the days, especially in early September, were still filled with the sounds of window air conditioners tirelessly groaning and fevered, pathologically optimistic discussions about the Red Sox.
Yet each year, there they were, these newly transplanted students, moving with the uncertainty of unseasoned tourists along the sidewalks of Harvard Square. Always burdened by too many layers of wool and fleece and an excess of shopping bags from the Harvard coop, packed with all the necessary desk gear and sweatshirts bearing the Harvard brand. The poor sweaty things. Even in her sleeveless white cotton t-shirt and ankle-length black rayon skirt, Alice felt uncomfortably damp by the time she reached Eric Wellman's office. Directly above hers, his was the same size, with the same furniture and the same view of the Charles River and Boston, but somehow his seemed more impressive and imposing. She always felt like a student whenever she was in his office, and that feeling hovered especially present today, as she'd been called in by him to talk for a minute. "How was your summer?" asked Eric. "Very relaxing. How was yours?" "Good. It went by too fast. We all missed seeing you at the conference in June." "I know, I missed being there." "Well, Alice, I wanted to talk with you about your course evaluations from last semester before classes begin." "Oh, I haven't even had a chance to look at them yet." An elastic-bound stack of evaluations from her motivation and emotion course sat somewhere in her office, unopened. Harvard's student evaluation responses were entirely anonymous and seen only by the instructor of the course and the chair of the department. In the past, she'd read them purely as a vanity check. She knew she was a great teacher, and her students' evaluations had always nodded in unwavering agreement. But Eric had never asked her to review them with him. She feared, for the very first time in her career, that she wouldn't like the image of herself she saw reflected in them. "Here, take a few minutes and look them over now." He handed her his copy of the stack with the summary page on top. On a scale from 1, disagree strongly, to 5, agree strongly, the instructor held students to a high standard of performance. All 4s and 5s. Class meetings enhanced an understanding of the material. 4s, 3s, and 2s. The instructor helped me to understand difficult concepts and complex ideas. Again, 4s, 3s, and 2s. The instructor encouraged questions and the consideration of differing viewpoints. 2 students gave her 1s. On a 1-5 scale from poor to excellent, give an overall evaluation of the instructor. Mostly 3s. If she remembered correctly, she'd never received lower than a 4 in this category. The entire summary page was splattered with 3s, 2s, and 1s. She didn't try to convince herself that it represented anything but the accurate and thoughtful judgment of her students, without malice. Her teaching performance had outwardly suffered more than she'd been aware of. Still, she'd be willing to bet anything that she was far from the worst-rated teacher in the department. She might be sinking fast, but she was nowhere near the bottom of the barrel. She looked up at Eric, ready to face the music. Maybe not her favorite tune, but probably not wholly unpleasant. "If I hadn't seen your name on that summary, I wouldn't have thought anything of it. It's decent, not what I've ever seen attached to you, but not horrible. It's the written comments that are particularly worrisome, and I thought we should talk." Alice hadn't looked beyond the summary page. He referred to his notes and read aloud. "She skips over huge sections of the outline, so you skip it too, but then she expects us to know it for the exam. She doesn't seem to know the information she's teaching. Class was a waste of time. I could have just read the textbook. I had a hard time following her lectures. Even she gets lost in them. This class was nowhere near as good as her intro course. Once she came to class and didn't teach, she just sat down for a few minutes and left. Another time she taught the exact same lecture she did the week before. I'd never dream of wasting Dr. Howland's time, but I don't think she should waste mine either." That was tough to hear. It was much, much more than she'd been aware of. "Alice, we've known each other a long time, right?"
"Yes."
"I'm going to risk being blunt and too personal here. Is everything okay at home?" Yes.
How about you then? Is it possible that you're overstressed or depressed?
No, that's not it.
This is a little embarrassing to have to ask, but do you think you might have a drinking or substance problem?
Now she'd heard enough.
I can't live with a reputation of being a depressed, stressed-out addict. Having dementia has to carry less of a stigma than that.
Eric, I have Alzheimer's disease.
His face went blank. He had been braced to hear about John's infidelity. He was ready with the name of a good psychiatrist. He was prepared to orchestrate an intervention or to have her admitted to McLean Hospital to dry out. He was not prepared for this.
I was diagnosed in January. I had a hard time teaching last semester, but I didn't realize how much it showed.
I'm sorry, Alice.
Me too.
I wasn't expecting this.
Neither was I.
I was expecting something temporary, something you would get past.
This isn't a temporary problem we're looking at.
No, it's not.
Alice watched him think. He was like a father to everyone in the department, protective and generous, but also pragmatic and strict.
Parents are paying $40,000 a year now. This wouldn't go over well with them.
No, it certainly wouldn't. They weren't shelling out astronomical dollars to have their sons and daughters learn from someone with Alzheimer's. She could already hear the uproar, the scandalous soundbites on the evening news.
Also, a couple of students from your class are contesting their grades. I'm afraid that would only escalate.
In 25 years of teaching, no one had ever contested a grade given by her. Not a single student.
I think you probably shouldn't be teaching anymore, but I'd like to respect your timeline. Do you have a plan?
I'd hope to stay on for the year and then take my sabbatical, but I hadn't appreciated the extent to which my symptoms were showing and disrupting my lectures. I don't want to be a bad teacher, Eric. That's not who I am.
I know it's not. How about a medical leave that would take you into your sabbatical year?
He wanted her out now.
She had an exemplary body of work and performance history, and most important, she had tenure. Legally, they couldn't fire her. But that was not how she wanted to handle this. As much as she didn't want to give up her career at Harvard, her fight was with Alzheimer's disease, not with Eric or Harvard University.
I'm not ready to leave, but I agree with you. As much as it breaks my heart, I think I should stop teaching. I'd like to stay on as Dan's advisor, though, and I'd like to continue to attend seminars and meetings.
I am no longer a teacher.
I think we can work that out. I'd like you to have a talk with Dan, explain to him what's going on, and leave the decision up to him. I'd be happy to co-advise with you if that makes either of you more comfortable. Also, obviously, you shouldn't take on any new graduate students. Dan will be the last.
I am no longer a research scientist.
You probably shouldn't be accepting invitations to speak at other universities or conferences. It probably wouldn't be a good idea for you to be representing Harvard in that kind of capacity. I have noticed that you've stopped traveling for the most part, so maybe you've already recognized this.
Yes, I agree.
How do you want to handle telling the administrative faculty and people in the department? Again, I'll respect your timeline here. Whatever you want to do. She was going to stop teaching, researching, traveling, and lecturing. People were going to notice. They were going to speculate and whisper and gossip. They were going to think she was a depressed, stressed-out addict. Maybe some of them already did.
I'll tell them. It should come from me.
September 17th, 2004. Dear friends and colleagues, upon thoughtful consideration and with deep sorrow, I have decided to step down from my teaching, research, and traveling responsibilities at Harvard. In January of this year, I was diagnosed with early-onset Alzheimer's disease. While I am likely still in the early to moderate stages of the disease, I've been experiencing unpredictable cognitive lapses that make it impossible for me to meet the demands of this position with the highest of standards that I've always held myself to and that are expected here.
While you'll no longer see me at the podium in the lecture auditoriums or busy writing new grant proposals, I will remain on as Dan Maloney's thesis advisor, and I'll still attend meetings and seminars, where it is my hope to continue to serve as an active and welcome participant. With greatest affection and respect, Alice Howland. The first week of fall semester, Marty took over Alice's teaching responsibilities. When she met with him to hand over the syllabus and lecture materials, he hugged her and said how very sorry he was. He asked her how she was feeling and if there was anything he could do. She thanked him and told him she was feeling fine. And as soon as he had everything he needed for the course, he left her office as fast as he could. Pretty much the same drill followed with everyone in the department. "I'm so sorry, Alice. I just can't believe it. I had no idea. Is there anything I can do? Are you sure? You don't look any different. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry." Then they left her alone as quickly as possible. They were politely kind to her when they ran into her, but they didn't run into her very often. This was largely because of their busy schedules and Alice's now rather empty one. But a not-so-insignificant reason was because they chose not to. Facing her meant facing her mental frailty and the unavoidable thought that, in the blink of an eye, it could happen to them. Facing her was scary. So for the most part, except for meetings and seminars, they didn't. Today was the first psychology lunch seminar of the semester. Leslie, one of Eric's graduate students, stood poised and ready at the head of the conference table with the title slide already projected onto the screen. "Searching for Answers: How Attention Affects the Ability to Identify What We See." Alice felt poised and ready as well, sitting in the first seat at the table across from Eric. She began eating her lunch, an eggplant calzone and a garden salad, while Eric and Leslie talked, and the room filled in. After a few minutes, Alice noticed that every seat at the table was occupied except for the one next to her, and people had begun taking up standing positions at the back of the room. Seats at the table were highly coveted, not only because the location made it easier to see the presentation, but because sitting eliminated the awkward juggling of plate, utensils, drink, pen, and notebook. Apparently, that juggling was less awkward than sitting next to her. She looked at everyone not looking at her. About 50 people crowded into the room, people she'd known for many years, people she'd thought of as family. Dan rushed in, his hair disheveled, his shirt untucked, wearing glasses instead of contact lenses. He paused for a moment, then went straight for the open seat next to Alice and declared it his by plopping his notebook down on the table. "I was up all night writing. Gotta get some food. Be right back." Leslie's talk ran the full hour. It took an excessive amount of energy, but Alice followed her to the end. After Leslie advanced past the last slide and the screen went blank, she opened up the floor to discussion. Alice went first. "Yes, Dr. Howland," said Leslie. "I think you're missing a control group that measures the actual distractibility of your distractors. You could argue that some, for whatever reason, simply aren't noticed, and their mere presence isn't distracting. You could test the ability of the subjects to simultaneously notice and attend to the distractor, or you could run a series where you swap out the distractor for the target." Many at the table nodded. Dan aha'd through a mouthful of calzone. Leslie grabbed her pen even before Alice finished her thought and took vigorous notes. "Yes, Leslie, go back to the experimental design slide for a moment," said Eric. Alice looked around the room. Everyone's eyes were glued to the screen. They listened intently as Eric elaborated on Alice's comment. Many continued nodding. She felt victorious and a little smug. The fact that she had Alzheimer's didn't mean that she was no longer capable of thinking analytically. The fact that she had Alzheimer's didn't mean that she didn't deserve to sit in that room among them. The fact that she had Alzheimer's didn't mean that she no longer deserved to be heard. The questions and answers and follow-up questions and answers continued for several minutes. Alice finished her calzone and her salad. Dan got up and came back with seconds.
Leslie stumbled through an answer to an antagonistic question asked by Marty's new postdoc. Her experimental design slide was projected on the screen. Alice read it and raised her hand.